Jason Redmond, a U.S. Navy SEAL, defied death's relentless grasp with a resilience that echoes through the annals of courage. His harrowing survival from an injury that should have been fatal stands as a testament to the indomitable human spirit. Redmond's story is not just one of overcoming adversity, it's a symphony of bravery, fueled by the unyielding camaraderie and relentless training of his fellow team members. Jason Redmond's journey is not merely about defying death. It's about embracing life with an unstoppable fervor that refuses to be extinguished. Welcome to another heart-stopping episode of Gold Shields. Gold Shields brings true stories from law enforcement, the military, true crime authors, and first responders. Experience the dedication, danger, and emotional toll with the heroes themselves. These gripping tales of true crimes, true stories, and true heroes are all here on Gold Shields.
Hey, Dan again here at Gold Shields with my partner in crime, Tom Smith. How you doing today, buddy?
I'm good, man. Looking forward to this for a while, man. What a great show we got coming up. Hey, you just want to get some housekeeping things out of the way. And our new sponsor, Lady Law Shield Law Firm with Bridget Truxillo. Big fan, big supporter of ours. And if you need someone to help you out in some difficulties in your workplace, Bridget's the one you want. LadyLawShield.com. Bridget Truxillo, hit her up. You're going to hear a lot more about her, but we just wanted to get that out on our first episode with her as our sponsor. Danny, who do we got on the show, buddy?
We're honored today to have a member of the Navy SEAL community who has distinguished himself not just in combat, but what he's done with his experiences in combat, which you're going to hear about today. They're amazing. You may have heard his name, Jason Redmond, and we are thrilled to have him on the show, and we can't wait to introduce him. He's waiting in the green room. Jason, how are you today, brother? Nice to meet you.
Dan and Tom, honored to be on, man. Big shout out to everyone in your audience. Man, I am a huge supporter of the Protector community, our LEOs, our fire that are out there, but specifically you guys, the LEO community right now, man, you're just, you're being thrown under the bus by a lot of leadership across this country. I can't stand seeing it. I know how hard it is to put yourself out there in harm's way. And it saddens me to see some of our citizens who want to throw law enforcement under the bus. No, I will always be behind you, beside you, in front of you, and helping to promote a very hard job that you guys do.
Well, thank you. Can we call you Jay? I understand that's acceptable.
Yeah, absolutely. You can call me Jay.
You know, there's a common thread that moves between military and law enforcement, which is that people are selfless and people are willing to risk their lives for strangers. And that's something that Tom and I salute. And we have nothing but the most profound respect for our military as well as law enforcement. But, you know, you had an amazing career in the military, 20 years in the Navy, U.S. Navy SEALs, most of that. Tell us about, we can talk all day long about the various operations you were on and counter-narcotics and terrorism activities and stuff that you were entrenched in with the SEALs. But there's one specific incident that has come to define you, and I hate to simplify it like that, but let's go to September of 2007, I believe it was Fallujah, correct?
Yeah, it was outside of Fallujah, northeast of Fallujah, a wonderful little vacation spot in the Anbar province of Iraq called Karma. My service dog is Karma, who immediately looked up at me when I said that. But Karma, Fallujah was a hotbed, obviously, of Al-Qaeda activity. The first big battle of Fallujah, the second push into Fallujah in 2006. And after that, it pushed some of the insurgency and Al-Qaeda out into the outer edges of Fallujah, into an area called Al-Karma. We found ourselves in Fallujah in 2007 and conducted operations all throughout the Anbar province and hit targets in Karma, in Fallujah. But really started to focus on Karma. The Marines had an outpost out there and were really getting hammered pretty heavily by Al-Qaeda and the insurgency out there. They were being just crushed with IEDs and ambushes and things like that. So our job being a direct action force, it was our job to go exterminate mid-level and high-level leaders of Al-Qaeda and the insurgency. And we started doing that in Karma. Karma was a really dangerous place. Almost every time we went in there, we got shot at. The very first mission of our deployment that I was not on that mission, which interestingly enough, the first mission of that deployment, I believe, was April 6th. And it fast forward and we'll come full circle. On September 13th, I was shot up, and the distance between these two targets was only probably half a kilometer. So amazing on that first mission. We had several guys wounded. Senior Chief Mike Day, who Mike is no longer with us, he unfortunately succumbed to the invisible wounds of war, but Mike became a legend that day. He was shot and fragged 27 times in that gunfight and still managed to get up and kill three terrorists after this incident. We lost a SEAL that day, Petty Officer Clark Schwedler. One of our guys in our troop was shot in the arm, and we lost an Iraqi, one of our Iraqi scouts. So that was the very first mission of our deployment. Fast forward to the end, and all these times we went into Karma and all these close calls, we had been tasked to find the number one leader for the Al-Qaeda organization in the Anbar province, the same individual who was in charge of the cell that shot all our guys up at that first mission. So a guy we'd been looking for all deployment, and told he was in a specific location very close to where that first mission had occurred. And we went in on that target. We took down the first target, and nothing was there. And that frequently happens. I mean, you guys as law enforcement could appreciate that. I mean, you execute a warrant sometimes and there's all the adrenaline and the hype and you go in ready and, you know, suddenly you go in and just the intel was dated or it was just wrong. And for us, we took down that initial target and no one was there. We found a lot of activity. We found indicators that someone had been there recently. And as we explored more and did our, what we call a sensitive site exploitation, where we're basically, you know, it's interesting. Special operations worked with law enforcement. We actually went and worked with the Boston PD to learn how to catalog evidence and search. So it was those techniques that we used when we were doing SSE, and we started finding bomb making materials. We started finding explosives, weapons, things like that. But we thought it was going to be a quiet night. We thought we were going to blow that stuff in place and that was going to be it. It's probably 2 a.m. in the morning, Iraq time now. I was in charge of the assault team that night. So I was an assault force commander, and we had stood down while our EOD guys and the external security team were completing the SSE. And our snipers noticed a whole lot of activity on another house about 150 yards to the north of us, which is uncommon in Iraq at that time. There was a curfew. And good people, as you guys, I'm sure, well know in law enforcement, typically good people don't run to the sound of guns. They hunker down and they get inside their house. Bad people start moving and twitching when gunfire and things are happening. So we started noticing a whole bunch of activity. Our snipers were watching and they said, "Hey, we just watched five individuals flee out of this house. They ran across the street and they hid in some vegetation across the street." So my boss came up to me and said, "Hey, Red, I want you to take your team. These guys are hiding. Let's go wrap them up. Let's go find out who they are and what they know." And these are things we had seen before. So took my team. We maneuvered up from the south to the north. We ended up in some pretty dense vegetation coming up, you know, from the south to where these guys had run. And what we didn't know was our number one leader had left the building that we were in, and he had gone to that other house 150 yards away. And he had a very large security detail. We estimate 12 to 15 individuals, and they had built an ambush line in that vegetation. Two PKM machine guns, which is a large belt-fed weapon, 7.62 by 54. And we estimate about 10 to 12 AK shooters. And my team and I walked right into that ambush, unfortunately. My medic was initially shot, took a round right below the knee, almost severed his leg. He dropped down in front. I was out front at this point trying to lay down fire. One of our other guys, Matt, ran forward and grabbed our medic and started to drag him back. We were out to the north and ahead of the vegetation at this point. And literally, if you went further to the north, there was nothing. Thousands of yards of empty Iraqi desert. So we just had the only point of cover we had, cover being something that'll stop bullets, was like a large, like John Deere sized tractor tire. And there was one lone tree. So DJ, one of our guys, got behind that tree and our other guys fell behind that tire. And I was still out front at this point. Matt grabbed our medic and started dragging him behind the tire. I was out front trying to lay down fire when both machine guns turned on me. And I was stitched across the body armor. I took two rounds in the left elbow, which I thought shot my arm off. I took rounds off my helmet, rounds off my gun. Had my left night vision tube shot off. I took rounds off my right side plate. And then turned, trying to get out of the line of fire. And that's when I caught a round in the face that entered right in front of my ear, traveled through my face, exited my nose, and kind of the right side of my cheekbone broke, kind of vaporized what was left of my cheekbone. The right side of the cheekbone broke and kicked out to the right. It vaporized my orbital floor. It broke all the bones above my eye, broke the head of my jaw, shattered my jaw to my chin, and it knocked me out. So the guy saw me fall and thought I was dead. This all happened in the first 5 minutes of the gunfight. The firefight ended up lasting what we estimate to be about 35 to 40 minutes. I don't know how long I was unconscious. Literally I was laying on my back and tracer fire from that machine gun was traveling directly over me. And this gunfight was happening directly above me. I was kind of pinned down right in between, the guys and the enemy. There was a lull in fire and I called out to my team leader and they realized at that point that I was still alive. In another lull in fire, my team leader ran forward and got me back to the tire and got a tourniquet on my arm, which I owe my life to my team leader. There's no doubt about it. They fought. I don't want to say I fought. I was out of the fight, man. I was in pretty bad shape at this point. The guys continued to fight back. Finally, my team leader, realized that we were bleeding out and we were going to die and we were going to run out of ammo on top of that. So we had an AC-130 gunship up overhead and he told the gunship, I need a fire mission. He'd already requested this twice. And unfortunately, the gunship had said, we were so close. The tire was probably only, when I was down on the ground, I was only 45 feet from the machine gun that had me pinned down. And then maybe add 10 yards to the tire when he ran forward and grabbed me and got me back. So we were well within what we call danger close parameters of the AC-130 gunship, meaning the explosive concussion and the fragmentation of the rounds coming off that aircraft are going to hit us. So that's what's called danger close parameters, and we were well within that. So the first two tries, they said, no, you guys got to figure out a way to move back. Finally, my team leader said, hey, there's no way. There's no place we can go. There's no cover. These guys are bleeding out. They're going to die. You just have to bring this in. And they put the onus on him. They said, hey, you're going to accept responsibility. If we kill you guys, it's your fault. And that exchange happened over the radio. I listened to this, you know, years later. And you know, people are like, oh, my God, I can't believe this happened. But you have to understand, we created these things to do everything in our power to protect friendly forces. And we have killed friendly forces and friendly fire aircraft incidents. So all these things were put in place to prevent that. And the gunship was only doing what was right to try and prevent a fratricide incident where they would kill us. And we had to accept that, hey, this could happen. We could die in our own in our own close air support that we're calling. So so I remember laying there and hearing the machine gun churn away, and my team leader, you know, called out, "Hey, incoming!" And the you know, it's nighttime. It's you know, 3 a.m. in the morning or so. The gunship flies at a pretty high altitude. So they're far away. So there's a standoff. You'll hear the gun go off, boom, 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 boom. And then you're waiting, 1, 1,000, 2, 3. And then all of a sudden, boom, the rounds hit the ground in front of us and blew up over us. And thankfully, none of us were hit. But it took out that machine gun and wounded several of their fighters. And we ended up calling in, I think 5 or 6 40 millimeter missions, which enabled us to finally be able to take the enemy out to where we could bring in the medevac, and they medevaced us. And then we pretty much vaporized that whole area with 105 millimeter rounds, which is the larger round. Kind of funny. This is the casing that was given to me from one of these gunship crews. So this is the bottom part of a 105 round. They're about this big. This is actually a 40 millimeter round, which was initially called in. But it ended up being the closest fire mission in the entire Iraq war, literally rounds on our position. So I owe my life to the gunship, 4 Special Operations Squadron, and I owe my life to my teammates, my team leader, all those guys for fighting back. And then, you know, ultimately, I owe my life to the amazing medical crew in Baghdad who saved me. I was pretty critical by the time I got there.
I mean, listen, before we get into actually you, talk about, you just laid out warfare. I mean, you just laid out what everyone kind of imagines or thinks about a war. You just laid out the decisions that have to get made, the treatments that have to be performed in an instant to save your life. You know, you think about, and the first thing I thought of was how smart and how intelligent and knowing your field. You have a major injury to your face, you know, that I'm sure is evident to the individual who grabbed you. But his first thought was to stop the bleeding in your arm. I mean, that's genius. That's just flat out instinctive training to see probably what your face looked like, but not to ignore it, but to go to where is going to be the more critical injury. And like you stated, it saved your life, even though the injury to your face is still present. I mean, that's incredible to have that. What's so impressive to me is in the middle of that firefight, bullets, airships, to think that clearly, to do that is just as impressive as it gets. I mean, my God, right, Dan?
Yeah, you know, it's an amazing story to listen to. And, you know, Tom and I were not in the military, did not serve in the war. But we've seen plenty of people shot in our career. Lots of people shot, some of them we knew. But shot basically with street weapons, with handguns, with the occasional Uzi, Tech 9, weapons like that, but nothing like 7.6. I mean, if you get hit as many times, that's so traumatic to even observe. But to have it go through one of your own and that commander having to make those decisions in a field like that, that's a testament to the training and the level of excellence that the Navy SEALs personify. I mean, you guys, to be cool under fire is anti-human, right? It's not human. But to be human under a crisis situation is to panic, to flip out, to not know what to do, to make bad decisions, or to go into denial and freeze. But in your situations that you found yourself in as a Navy SEAL, the people you were with, your training and your experience brings you to places where you can transcend the moment and think almost clinically. And as detective, people say, so how do you go to like crime scenes and look at that stuff? Well, after a while, you start looking at it clinically. Start looking for entry and exit wounds. You start looking for witnesses, looking for evidence. You're looking at it clinically as opposed to, oh my God, I can't believe what I'm looking at. So, but to be able to do that in the middle of that type of fire, it's just an amazing story. And, you know, the world's a better place for the people that we have like you who protect us. We're, you know, so much respect for you. But
and I appreciate that, Dan and Tom. But the reality is that comes down to training. Obviously, SEALs display and our special operations members display a level of there's two things that make special operations. I always try and tell people this. Number one, it is an individual's ability to endure discomfort longer than the average person. And number two, it is the ability to process massive amounts of information and make very quick decisions. Those two things are what make special operations members. But training is what makes us who we are on the battlefield. We take these two things and then we take it to this level. And the SEAL teams, in my opinion, probably do some of the best training in the entire U.S. military. But that translates, you nailed it. I mean, for the average, you say, oh, this is superhuman. The average person can't do this. Well, the average person has zero training. It is one of the reasons why I run a workshop called the Overcome and Survive Workshop, because I meet so many people out there who own a gun, but they're afraid of it. They don't know how to shoot it. They're more dangerous to themselves than anybody else is the reality. So I want to provide a level of training. I feel like, man, every American citizen should own a gun and you should know how to use it. You should understand backstops and legal. You also should understand basic first aid. You should understand survival. You should understand how to de-escalate a situation before it ever becomes a situation, or A, avoid a situation. Those are all things we teach, but all that comes back to training. And we tell people in the course, there's the trained and there's the untrained, and you're going to revert to the lowest level of training, which is if you've had none, that's it. So anyways, I appreciate you saying that, but the reality is, you guys have a level of training. You know, special operations has a level of training. Our tier one unit, SEAL Team 6 Delta, have probably the highest level of training that's out there. That's what makes them exceptional. Obviously they have, you know, superhuman abilities. But the people need to understand, if you want to be better in this life, you need to train.
Yeah, in anything. You're right. In anything.
So true. So true. The one question I had before we get into your recovery and what you got going on now, which is incredible. The one thing that popped into my mind, you know, you get knocked out and you're laying there. When you come to, do you go, holy crap, I'm alive? Like, does it, oh, wow, okay, I'm in this still. Do you have enough in you? Like, I understand what's going on in your injuries, but do you actually just, like, take a second and go, oh, damn, okay, I'm alive?
Well, sort of. And actually, I'm glad you brought this back up. It was a point I wanted to make, because I think it's a critical point for any of you listening to this show who are still active duty law enforcement. Several things happened. When I came to, I wasn't quite aware enough to be like, oh my God, I'm still alive. There never was a break in consciousness in my mind from when I was hit and when I came to. Because I, in the hospital, the doctors were like, how long were you unconscious? I was like, I've never lost consciousness. That is what I told them. I told the doctors at Bethesda that multiple times. It wasn't until my teammates got home, they were like, bro, you were totally out. Like, you drifted in and out of consciousness throughout the firefight. So the elation of recognizing I was still alive didn't happen until after I came out of the very first surgery. What happened on the battlefield was, yes, I definitely realized when I finally came to, I was like, holy shit, like, you're still in the middle of this. And there was a quick recognition of several things. Number one, I started recognizing tracer fire traveling directly over me. I was laying flat on my back, and machine gun fire was only traveling about 8 inches above me, and my teammates were shooting above me at the enemy. So the very first cognizant thought I had was, don't sit up. Like, you're literally going to sit up into gunfire. And the second thought was, you're out of the fight. Like, you are totally combat ineffective. You can't get up because you're going to sit up into a hail of gunfire. I also recognized I was bleeding out. I couldn't get my own tourniquet on. I tried. This is, you know, just awareness. I had fixed my tourniquet to the bottom of my body armor with three really strong rubber bands. We have these really thick rubber bands that we use on parachutes. And yeah, when you jump out of a plane at 120 miles an hour, it rips those rubber bands apart. And when you're healthy and strong, you have no issues. You know, with a little bit of strength, you could pop these rubber bands. Well, guess what? When I lost a whole lot of blood, I couldn't break these rubber bands. So it's something to think about. Tourniquet placement is critical. You should think about, you're going to be weak when you go for your tourniquet, and you need to think about the weird positions you may be in, you know, left arm, right arm, whatever it is, wherever your tourniquet is, you need to think about trying all the different positions, because what happened to me, I never was able to get my tourniquet off and get it on me. Thank God my team leader did. The second thing I realized was I had to be patient. I had to wait for my teammates to win the gunfight. I knew there was nothing I could do, and I just trusted them that they were going to do what we had been trained to do, and they were going to win that fight and get to me. I mean, don't get me wrong. I told myself my job was to survive, and I was telling myself, stay awake, stay alive, stay awake, stay alive. And there were, you know, a few moments towards the end that I didn't think I was going to make it. I thought I was going to die before we got off that battlefield. So I owe my life to my teammates. I owe my life to the big man above. But that if you were in a gunfight, recognize, you know, don't make the situation worse for yourself. I would have made the situation worse for myself if I had tried to get up and try and get involved in the gunfight. One, mentally and physically, I wasn't in the right place to do it. Number two, it was a terrible situation for me to try and reengage. I would have just got a shot again and created more problems for my team. So you need to evaluate, you know, what's the best way I can help my team? Well, in this case, the best way was I needed to just be patient and let them do what they needed to do. And they did. I owe my life, well, like I said, my teammates and my team leader that night.
You get brought from there to, I guess, battlefield or behind the lines sort of medical treatment. Surgery's done, some stabilizing work. You eventually find your way back to Bethesda, Maryland, U.S. National Naval Medical Center. Is that right? And tell us about what happened there. I mean, just the sheer numbers of the things that, if you don't mind, like how many surgeries, stitches, skin grafts, you went through a lot of medical work.
Yeah, it was, since my injuries, it's now, I think, 40 surgeries total. I haven't rattled these numbers off in a long time, but we estimate it was almost 1,500 stitches, hundreds and hundreds of staples. It was multiple external fixators. I was trached. I was wired shut. I had multiple bone grafts, cartilage grafts. I had multiple, they had a titanium orbital floor under my eye because my orbital floor was vaporized. That, after a couple of years, my body started to reject that. I was having infection issues. So they actually went back in and they removed a piece of my skull, peeled off a layer of my skull, put it back, and put that piece of my skull under my eye for my new orbit. I've had my jaw reconstructed. I've had my jaw wired shut, rebroken and wired shut three times. I had my nasal reconstruction. This was the third one. It was the third time of nasal reconstruction for them to rebuild it. I've had tissue grafts off multiple parts of my body, skin grafts off multiple parts of my body. I had a what's called a fibular free flap, so they needed bone in my face to replace. The structural integrity of my skull was compromised, so they needed bone to replace the missing bone in my cheek. So this was a relatively new groundbreaking surgery back then. They actually removed, you have two bones in your leg. The front bone, the thicker one, is your tibia. 95% of your weight is on that bone. And the rear bone is called the fibula. It's more of a stability bone. Works well for movements, you know, those two bones kind of turn as you do things. So they cut out 10 inches of my fibula along with blood vessels, and they cut that up, maintaining that blood flow, and they placed that into my face to reconstruct my cheek and face. So really amazing, but 4 years, almost 40 surgeries to put me back together. My arm originally, they had planned on amputating it above the elbow. The only reason I still have an arm, and a little bit of this is, you know, I call it miracle, God moment. You can call it serendipity. You can call it luck. But the only reason I still have an arm is because the head of orthopedics at Bethesda, when I showed up, happened to be a former SEAL. And his whole team said we should cut off his arm because I had no use of my hand. I had massive nerve damage and the elbow was totally destroyed. And they said the best case is cut off his arm above the elbow and he'll have a good outcome. And he said, no, we're not going to do that. He saved my arm. And I can't bend my arm any further than this and I can't extend any further than that. But I have some nerve damage, but I still have use of my hand and arm now. And I owe that to him. Like he took a stance against, you know, many very, very talented doctors who said this is the best outcome. So crazy journey. The medical process is very difficult. People don't understand that when you get shot or blown up, bullets and traumatic injuries like that are very dirty, especially overseas. There are bacteria and there are things overseas that, you know, the average American is not exposed to. And we get exposed to it when you're laying there bleeding out in the soil or you've had dirty bullets shot into you or whatever it is. So many of us have infection issues. I had major infection problems. And it just is a very long, hard, arduous road.
What an incredible listing of the medical work. And talk about luck, you call it serendipity, God moment. To have that surgeon have been a SEAL and to be influential enough to persuade them to keep your arm, I'm really glad he did. I'm sure you are every day. But you had great medical treatment and you come back basically from a place that for many years on battlefields, people had no chance of that. But medical advances and all that other stuff have given guys like you a chance to have a life after what could have been and probably in all rights should have been a life-ending injury on a battlefield. But I'm glad to see that we have that kind of stuff in America, and I'm glad you're with us. And I'm sure a lot of people are glad that you're with us because of the work that you do now. And let's talk a bit about that now. If you're okay with us segueing into what you've been involved in since you left your active military service.
Yeah, I've been involved in a whole lot of things. I finished my military career. That was one of the biggest things. I actually tried to stay operational after I was wounded. And unfortunately, I was never able to bend my arm further than this. That became a pretty big limiting factor in my ability to operate anymore. But I was given the option, well, hey, do you want to medically retire? And I said, well, no, not yet. I came in to do 20 years. I want to finish my career. So I'm very thankful the SEAL teams and the Navy took care of me. And I spent the last, 4 years of my career working at one of the highest levels of the SEAL teams, working in ops, working special projects, working some training things. So still being able to contribute and finish my career on my terms, maybe not operational, but at least still giving back and making a difference. So I retired from the Navy in August of 2013. And I launched a nonprofit and I was helping wounded warriors. Wounded Warrior was the clothing line and we expanded into events and making an impact. My book came out in November of 2013, The Trident, which I had worked with the community to make sure I was delivering a message that was right, that I wasn't talking about anything I shouldn't. So the community gave the thumbs up that. So I just wanted to try and help others, whether it was wounded warriors or other individuals. I had a unique story. It was a story of leadership failure. A lot of people don't know that. I failed as a young leader, as a young SEAL officer several years prior to my injuries. And a large part of my story of that first book is about that journey. It is about growing up and coming to understand what it is to be a leader, especially to lead people in dangerous jobs. So I knew that story resonated, this story of resilience and leadership, and I started getting out and telling that story more and more. That began to grow. Many people who read that book would say to me, hey, how did you do what you did? We don't understand. You know, how did you overcome this massive failure in leadership and come back at this high level? How were you severely injured and you came back at this high level? And I'll be honest, in the beginning, I don't know if I could really answer all those questions. So over several years of really writing and speaking and analyzing these things, it led to my second book called Overcome. I tell people the Trident is the story, which did really well. It was a New York Times bestseller. But Overcome is the how-to. And it's been really amazing now to have people that have read that book. I frequently talk about this concept of, I survived this vicious enemy ambush, but everybody gets ambushed in life. There are life ambushes that happen all the time. And you know, it's not the bullets and bombs of battle, it's the bullets and bombs of life. And they can be equally or even more devastating. They can be anything from the ending of a relationship, they could be divorce, they could be failure, they could be business or personal failure, they could be professional failure, they could be lawsuit, bankruptcy, it could be sexual trauma, it could be illness or injury to you or someone you love, or it could be the death, unexpected death of someone you love. And one of the biggest life ambushes that I've seen is the loss of a child. All of these things are very similar to everything that I experienced. And it became this idea that we talk about in police and in the military, specifically in special operations, that you have to get off the X. My team was able to get off the X the night from that ambush. And I came to learn and see that I got off the X from my leadership failure. I've experienced some other life ambushes since then, and now I try and teach people to have a mindset, an overcome mindset, to deal with the adversity that we all encounter in this life. It's the opposite of the narrative that's out there. We are living in a world right now, I often joke that, the pandemic is still upon us, and people are like, are you talking about COVID? And I'm talking about, no, I'm talking about the victim mindset. It's as if we're trying to convince everybody in this country that they're a victim. Race, creed, color, gender persuasion, demographic, religion, you name it, socioeconomic status. We want to convince you that you are a victim. Hell, white privilege, you're a victim. Although nobody wants to hear that. But I mean, it's the reality. We're just convincing everyone that they're a victim and everybody's buying into this. And I am 100% against that. I am of the idea and the belief, and I know it's true, that you drive your ability to overcome. I mean, it starts with you. I don't care how great the cavalry is. If we drag you off the X and you just want to be a victim, you're just going to crawl right back onto it. So you have to get off the X under your own power and drive forward. And that is really the heart and soul of what I am teaching now, trying to teach people to be better leaders. Guys, you need to be a better father, mentor, and get off that X.
You know, it's so impressive. And we've had the unbelievable privilege of having other special operators on, other Navy SEAL. You know, we just mentioned a few, Sully, Hector, Tim, all that. And the one distinction that I keep kind of coming up with, the Navy SEALs are so into giving back. I mean, you guys are just so focused on doing what you need to do at the ultra highest level. And then when you're done, not just saying you're done, not just going, okay, hey, I had a great career, later, everybody. You guys just continuously work and bring what you have and your experiences and what you can give back to not just the community, but to everybody. I mean, you know, because your message isn't just in the military community. It's like you just said, in life, because everyone runs into obstacles. Everyone runs into ambushes, as you said. And to get through them is so important. And when you have someone who's gone through it at the craziest levels of Navy SEAL operators, and then to listen to them and read their stories in the books, is just, it's such a way to give back and to continue your service. That's really impressive. Very impressive.
Thank you.
So, you know, your message of resiliency and toughness in the face of a challenge, to say the least. I love the, I read something about a note that you had pinned to your hospital door, alerting visitors of what to expect and how to behave and what your mindset should be like before you walk into my hospital room. And I love it. And it basically says, I'm not feeling sorry for myself. I don't want you coming in here feeling sorry for me. This is a room full of optimism, fight, courage, determination. And it just, when I read it, I was like, this sums up what makes people successful in any area of life, which is resiliency. We're all going to face those challenges. How do you get through it? How do you get stronger and learn something from it rather than just go around it or have somebody bail you out? How do you do just what you said? Get off the X. And I love that mindset. I love the victor mindset of no matter what's thrown at me, I can figure this out. And I just love that you're using that right now. And you do motivation speaking. Tell us about the business of this that you do. Motivation speaking, consulting. Tell us about it. And how can our listeners get in touch with you or find out more about that?
Yeah, I speak all across the country, nationally, even a little bit internationally. I'm just humbled and honored to be able to do it, to share my story and make it relatable. And that's been one of the coolest things. I think there's a lot of military speakers who have an amazing story, but it doesn't always translate directly into something relatable that people can walk away with. And it's been such a powerful thing over the years to have people say to me, wow, I can't tell you how much I needed that, how much it's helped me to get off the X and drive forward and be a better leader, be a better entrepreneur, to be a better dad, whatever it is, or overcome some major crisis, or they've been stuck on the X in their life. So yeah, I speak all across the country. I speak corporate, law enforcement, fire, military. I have a lower rate for obviously our protector community. I want to be able to give back, and I know they don't have the budgets to pay for high level speakers. So I try and keep that, you know, low enough that I can still give back and share and help them. They can find me at jasonredman.com. I'm doing coaching. I'm a founding member of an amazing group called the Legacy Tribe. And we basically want individuals to be the best version of themselves physically, personally, and professionally, and to level up in those areas of their lives. So I partnered with a very high-level, successful entrepreneur by the name of Bedros Koulian. Bryce Henson is the CEO of Fit Body Bootcamp. And then I bring on the mindset and the resilient side of this program. So we open this program up 4 times a year to our members to join. And it is all about just becoming better in all aspects of your life.
Wow. I mean, again, you know, it's just understanding you have a skill, understanding you have just so much to give to other people and taking that on. Let me tell you, man, we've been blessed to have had so many great guests on our show through the time we've been on. And yours is no different. The words of inspiration that you deliver and your attitude, I think, is the biggest thing. You know, you can list all the injuries you've had, what you've gone through, you see it every day, your injuries, but your attitude is amazing, man. I mean, it's contagious. It's so refreshing to see that, because listen, you know, any of us, and we've all been through it, you know, you would at a very high level, me and Dan in the police department, when we've seen injuries happen, we've seen, you know, friends of ours have to leave the job and they get into this just bad place in their life that they need to dig themselves out of. And when you see you have the attitude you have, it's inspiring, man. You really are. And God bless you.
Yeah, thank you, guys. I mean, I'll leave everybody with one thing. The greatest gift you have in this life is you have a choice. No one forced you to lay there and feel sorry for yourself and sit on that X, man. You got free will. Choose to drive forward. Choose positivity.
Thank you. Thank you, Jason, for your message of recovery, of resiliency, of mental toughness, of shedding the victim mindset that, frankly, has crippled a lot of the world. COVID didn't help it, but it's embedded now. People have to understand that when things happen in their life, it's not because somebody's trying to pick on them or mess with them. It's just life. And life, how you respond to challenges is what defines you. And the definition of bravery, courage, and toughness is what you have lived out, Jason. And we appreciate you more than you know. And I know that you're going to touch a lot of lives in your work. You're going to help a lot of people see things better. And it's a mission of empowerment. You know, get out there and tell people, stop feeling sorry for yourself. Get over this. Get over that. Move on and make a situation better. So anyway, we can't thank you enough. We look forward. We want everybody to read your books. 3 excellent books. Look at your website, jasonredman.com. If you can't book them for your gatherings, at least read his books. Understand, be able to share the messages that he's sharing with us that he has learned the hard way. Right, Tom?
Absolutely. Jason, thank you so much for your time, what you've done for this country, and what you're continuing to do for a number of communities that are out there with your work, with your foundation, you know, or your organization. So thank you so much for your time and everything you've done for this country, brother.
Yeah, guys, my honor. Appreciate it. Appreciate all you guys out there listening.
Next time we're down to Virginia Beach or anywhere near that area, we want to make sure we get a chance to buy you a steak. And Tom wants to talk to you more about his scrapbooking and how that's his passion. So we know that you probably appreciate that. Totally kidding.
Yeah.
Not everybody gets that. Yeah. if you know Tom, that's so unlike him. Anyway, we're probably going to edit that out. We have a blooper reel we'll deal with. But thank you, Jason. Thank you so much. Tom, take us out, as you always do.
Yep. Again, Jason, thank you so very much for your time. Like we always do, especially when we have episodes like this, keep law enforcement in your prayers, all the military members, vets out there, special operators that do an unthinkable job in areas of this world that none of us would want to be in. And they do it voluntarily, and they're out there doing God's work, protecting this country and protecting all of us so we could do exactly what we're doing here today. So, Jason Redman, thank you so much. My partner, Dan Murphy, this is Tom Smith again for Gold Shields. And don't forget, youtube.com/Gold Shields. Hit that subscribe button. Hit the bell so you get notified of all these great episodes like this one with Jason Redman. Again, stay safe, everyone. We'll see everybody soon.